Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Buckner Edwards. There she is. Okay, who's kin to the Buckner Edwards? Okay.
I'm Regina Vithin Arden, and for the BBC World Service, I'm in the United States for a series looking at some of the ways in which race continues to trouble this country. Stories like the deaths of young black men in Ferguson and Baltimore and the shooting at a church in Charleston have thrust the issue of race into the spotlight. Those three cities are spread across the United States, but what struck me when I reported from each of them, and when I visited many other American cities in the north as well as the south of this country, is how blacks and whites seem to live quite separately. So how did it get to be like this? Well, in this programme, I'll be trying to answer that question and looking at how it impacts race relations today.
Okay, Alexander Vanderbilt. Okay, Bates Williams.
In the town hall in the tiny township of Nicodemus in western Kansas, a group of black families is attending a reunion. Some are holding balloons with their names on. There's the Schweitzers, the Alexanders, the Van der Waals, the Bates. And as laughter bubbles, camera phones click.
Schweitzer Van der Waal needs a pink, a blue, a green dot.
People line up next to their names as they work out a living family tree. They might not all be related to each other, but they do all have one thing in common. They're all descendants of the first settlers who came to this remote part of America's Midwest to build homes, communities and lives after they were freed from slavery. Kansas was a state which had fought battles over the right of black people to be free. 12 miles west of here, another group of settlers set up the all-white Hill City.
And the young man back there, who's kin to the Sayers Jones? Sarah Jones.
The segregation isn't as stark today in western Kansas, but across this country, and despite the end of slavery and the successes of the civil rights movement in ending legal segregation, many Americans, black and white, still live very separate lives. To understand why and how that happened, you only have to drive a couple of hours to the other side of Kansas. Just over the Missouri River and the state line, in Kansas City, Missouri, I met up with historian Bill Worley, who's written extensively about the city's most famous property developer, J.C. Nichols.
He talked about building a neighborhood that was a good place to live in. That was actually a slogan of Kansas City at the beginning of the 20th century, and so he took that and actually pretty much delivered on the promise.
A good place to live in if you're white. You're holding a piece of paper in your hand. There was something crucial that he actually introduced.
Basically, what he was doing was to try to create a way to perpetuate a neighborhood, which from his perspective included one essential component, which said that ownership or occupancy of this property by Negroes, except as servants, was prohibited.
That would shock a lot of people listening to this.
Well, certainly in the early 21st century, it would. He found it a good sales device.
The idea that stopping black people from buying property was a good sales device is startling today. But what Nichols did was perfectly legal. He even persuaded the federal government to copy the policy. And soon, the Kansas City model was taken on by other developers. Huge new all-white suburbs sprang up across the country. Kansas City's black residents couldn't move to these new suburbs, but they did enjoy a separate and vibrant life of their own in the district around 18th Street and Vine, which is where I headed next.
This was a jazz and business district. All these buildings that you see here now used to be black-owned businesses. Clothing stores, hat stores, shoe stores, suit stores. It used to be some of the greatest tailors in the black community were on this side of the street.
That's Eric Wesson, a columnist and reporter for one of the oldest black newspapers in the country, the Kansas City Call. As I wandered around the area near Eric's office, I saw old neon signs and faded shop fronts, reminders that this was once a thriving black centre, famous for its jazz. And the reason for this area's demise might surprise you.
On the other side of the streets were all the juke houses, the clubs, the jazz centers, where people came and hung out once they got paid.
And today, that's all gone.
Today, that's all gone. The vision and identity of the district has been changed. So it's not really a business area anymore.
How did this area go from what you were describing to what we're seeing now?
Desegregation. And when desegregation came, people, businesses brought people out of this area into other parts of the city to make money. And when they did that, they took everything away. The base was taken away from here.
The desegregation was a problem, you're saying, in terms of generating and keeping black businesses going.
Yes, it definitely hurt the black community. Because when businesses were here, we were forced to engage each other. We were forced to spend money with each other. But then when they took this economic base out of here and they put it in other parts of the city, that weakened the community and they did away with that base. So now we're left with a shell of what we used to have.
And across America, where integration has happened, the outcome's been mixed. It's not always been positive. Yet it's hard to see how the United States transcends its racial history without it. Leah Bustan is an economic historian looking at racial differences in housing. She uses census data to compare individual parts of cities to their overall racial composition. Oh, the times they are
changing. Residential segregation has been increasing over the long term, but lately it has been decreasing from its peak. So starting in around the year 1900, residential segregation rose for 7 consecutive decades, and it peaked in 1970. And since then, residential segregation has been declining. At this point, the latest census we've had is 2010. So in 2010, segregation levels were almost back to where they had been in 1900. So we're almost back to historical lows. We've had basically a big sweep up and then a big sweep down. There are a number of demographic factors that are underlying the sweep down. The two biggest ones have been blacks moving out of central cities into suburban towns, and blacks moving from the industrial cities of the north and west, the old Rust Belt, for example, back to southern cities. And it may seem odd because we have stereotypes about the South being the most racist region in the country, but actually residential segregation levels are lowest in southern cities and have been declining fastest. So if we think about, for example, the 10 largest cities in the U.S., 3 of them are located in the South, and that would be Atlanta, Houston, and Dallas. And for those cities, the residential segregation levels are substantially lower, 20 to 30% lower than their northern counterparts.
So it sounds like Americans from different races are spending more time together. But are they, in a city like Atlanta, for example?
Well, we have a sense from the census data that whites and blacks in Atlanta are sharing the same neighborhoods. And so they're probably bumping into each other out on the street. They're driving past each other, walking past each other, and going to the same stores, using the same buses in the neighborhood or the same parks. But whether they're actually engaging each other in conversation, whether they're inviting each other to the same block parties, I mean, that's something that you need to actually physically go and get a sense of how life is lived.
And so that's precisely what I did, taking up an offer to visit Lewis and Nicole Anderson, who I met in Nicodemus and whose family have featured in all of these programmes on the BBC World Service.
My name is Minister Nicole Anderson, and I'm here to welcome you to Tabernacle of Praise, where praise meets you.
After the Sunday service, where Nicole was ministering and Lewis was assisting the pastor, I sat down with them over lunch to talk.
there's still segregation here. And it's obvious in different areas. You can still see the differences in race in different communities all across this area, even where we are right now today. So, yes, the statistics say one thing, but, you know, when you drive past the homes, it gives a different story. It really does.
Exactly. I would say if you were looking at a demographic by zip code, you would be accurate. But if you were to actually look at the subdivisions, the school districts, that's where you see the differences. It even gets segregated by store. Mm-hmm. For example, this restaurant they ran is something that commingles with everyone. And you go to another one, it's going to be predominantly white. So segregation is very much here and actually accepted by all races.
Nicole, some people listening to this might say, well, why, if you want to live next door to white families, why don't you just buy a house in a white area?
For us, we built our house from the ground up. So we had no idea who would be there, but the realtors did. So when we got there, you know, we saw a few whites and we were very excited because we wanted to have a diverse community. We wanted that.
It actually, I think, starts when the realtors step in. They, to a large extent, create the culture of that subdivision.
So you're talking about people, estate agents?
Yes, real estate agents, correct. So let's say, for example, and this has happened to us, I've gone to a subdivision in a predominantly white city, which has predominantly white subdivisions. One to look at some homes, and immediately you'll hear, you have to come back, we'll be able to do this in 30 days or something like that.
They will refuse to show you available properties, perhaps, that are in a white area because they wouldn't want you to want to buy
that.
They
won't refuse, but they would deter.
There's plenty of evidence to suggest that Lewis and Nicole aren't alone in being encouraged to live in so-called black areas. It's one of the reasons why integrating communities has proved so elusive. But perhaps that's also because the federal government, which in every other sphere of life has been at the centre of efforts to eradicate racial inequality, has never used the tools it has at its disposal. That's about to change, though. So I've come to Washington, D.C. to meet with Julian Castro, the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development and a member of President Obama's cabinet.
The Fair Housing Act commanded that communities that receive HUD money do what they can to affirmatively further fair housing. The problem is that for many years, that requirement was never adequately either defined or enforced. And so this rule both gives new tools to the communities that we grant dollars to understand how they can create more fair housing opportunities for people of modest means and people of different backgrounds, and then also comes with a stronger resolve that those communities that are absolutely unwilling to do that are more likely to end up on our radar screen and be enforced against.
When you say people of modest means, we're talking about low-income families, but often that's people of color.
A lot of times here in the United States, it's true that low-income communities are disproportionately people of color. At the same time, it includes people of every background. And so we hope that this is going to have a positive impact in terms of helping to further desegregate communities.
This means if they build anything new, they have to make sure that they invest in some of the areas that were particularly deprived. Is that how this works?
It means two things. First of all, that when these local communities are investing their dollars, they're not ignoring distressed urban areas. But secondly, that they're also not concentrating poverty in just one area of town.
When we were in Atlanta for this program, we met a young black couple who said that when they were trying to find a house and they went to estate agents, realtors, they were only shown certain houses because they were black.
It is not surprising to hear about their experience because as much as all of us in our nation would like to believe that that kind of discrimination does not happen, the fact is that in our housing market, it does happen every day. And HUD has an Office of Fair Housing that is dedicated to leveling the playing field. And one of the things that we do is to partner with local nonprofits to use testers. And in the last analysis that was done a couple of years ago, we found that African Americans were shown about 12% less properties. So the situation that you're describing and this anecdote is very real.
But Secretary, it's shocking. So what can you do to close that gap?
Well, so when that occurs and complaints are filed, HUD does pursue complaints against landlords. In fact, during this Obama administration, we have helped recover about $330 million.
How fundamental is housing to solving America's race issue?
Housing is so fundamental to just about every aspect of our lives. And with regard to race in this country, housing patterns have defined how people have oftentimes separated themselves, sometimes joined together. But we ought to have policy and housing patterns that encourage people of different backgrounds to be able to live together and to work together and build fantastically productive and diverse communities in this nation.
But in the meantime, housing segregation has another very important effect, because children go to school where they live. So if they live separately, they'll be educated separately. Back in Kansas, in the city of Topeka, a couple of hours from Nicodemus, where I began my journey, the two strands came together in probably the most famous and significant court case in 20th century American history. Brown versus the Board of Education.
My lonely days are over.
My name is Cheryl Brown Henderson, and I am the youngest daughter of Oliver Brown, for whom Brown versus the Board of Education is named, and founding president of the Brown Foundation.
The Brown case was a legal landmark, a unanimous decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. It marked the beginning of the end for legal segregation in the United States and came with a ringing moral denunciation of segregation. But its legacy in education has been complicated.
You gained something, but you lost something. I think the gain was much greater, but there was a true loss in terms of that sense of community and, you know, being your brother and sister's keeper. When I went to school in the wake of Brown with, you know, white teachers, kindergarten through graduate school, there was not that sense of community. There was not that sense of acceptance and warmth. And there was not that sense of belonging. And education really had to be for you, you know, for yourself. Because during my mom's era, my sister's era, you know, teachers were so committed to making sure they educated their students of color. They would come to your home if you needed tutoring. Well, after Brown, you know, a lot of the educators that had African-American students in their classrooms for the first time weren't necessarily accepting of that.
And so were there fewer black teachers in the wake of that decision? Is that what you're saying?
Let me just give you this example. There were 22 elementary schools in Topeka. Four of those schools were segregated for African-Americans. So when those four schools, you know, now said the students in these schools can now attend all 22 schools, you know, it doesn't mean there were fewer teachers. It means there were more classrooms for them to teach in. And not to mention, some of them were fired because the school district made it clear that if the plaintiffs succeeded, then teachers of 3 years or fewer who were African-Americans would be let go, under the notion that there would not be enough white parents willing to have an African-American teacher for their children, that there wouldn't be enough work. So for 1 year, they had a policy that you had to call every parent of every white child in the fourth grade, if the fourth grade teacher was now black, and they discovered it was not necessary because no one said no. So it was a policy for 1 year. So those teachers were dispersed as well.
Before the case came to trial, many black people in Topeka feared that integration would see good black schools close, good black teachers fired, and black students taught by unsympathetic white teachers. And the awkward truth is that they were often right. I asked Cheryl how things could get better.
First of all, after Brown v. Board, we missed a huge opportunity, in my view. There should have been a major undertaking to make sure all teacher education programs included ethics and responsibility, because a lot of this was simply abdicating a responsibility as an educator, you know, and there was no one really holding them accountable for that. So little by little, you know, white educators that didn't want to be in a classroom that with black children at all, predominantly black, got to opt out. You know, that shouldn't have been allowed. Because as a former teacher, you know, back in the 70s, when I taught in a predominantly white classroom, you know, I wasn't looking to opt out. I was there to teach regardless. I taught predominantly black students at Monroe, where my mother and sisters had attended. I taught school there, and it was still predominantly African American in the 70s. When it closed, I transferred or was transferred to a school that was predominantly white. Kids were not a problem at all. The parents were. So a lot of this is grown-up problems that we heap on the shoulders of our children.
If Cheryl's right and children continue to shoulder the weight of their parents' views from generation to generation, then it's hard to see how America can overcome its racial problems. After Brown, the drive to prevent schools being integrated in towns and cities across America meant many white families simply moved out of central school districts, taking with them their tax dollars. That's largely where America finds itself today. That landmark Supreme Court decision, which has tortured children in their history lessons, didn't achieve all of its goals. For so many students, there's little meaningful interaction with other races in their formative years. So, how can things change? Well, it's one of the trickiest debates in the US, not least because there's little agreement politically. I've come to a city where they think they might have found part of that solution. It's early morning at the IB Academy in Hartford, Connecticut, America's Northeast. The bell's just gone, and as you can hear behind me, pupils are filing between their classes. But what strikes me here is how racially diverse the intake is. Principal Karen Stedman explains why.
Every year I have to report my statistics to the state to see that we are in compliance with the CHEF mandate. So I report the number of students who are from Hartford and then from suburban areas in each ethnic category. So, for example, this year I have 29 students who are Black or African American from Hartford and 32 from the suburban areas who are Black and African American. Hispanic and Latino from Hartford, 12, and from the suburban areas, 13.
The CHEF mandate, a requirement to report school diversity figures, comes from a 1996 court decision which forced Connecticut to get serious about integration in schools. It takes its name from one of the students who brought the case, Milo Sheff. His mother, Elizabeth Horton Sheff, is a long-term civil rights activist and explained what's happened in Hartford.
Children of color who were poor were segregated in urban centers where suburban centers right around enjoyed emollients that the children in the poorest schools didn't have, like new textbooks, like toilet paper. So simple things that we take for granted. So we took three tenets of the state constitution and sued for our children's constitutional rights.
And what changes have come about as a consequence?
Since we filed the suit, we have increased the occurrence of quality integrated education for about 43% of Hartford students.
And what's the knock-on effects that that has for the wider community as well?
Well, it produced a couple of things. First of all, you'll see that there are children who are achieving now who were not achieving before. You see a better high school graduation rate. You see better test scores. In fact, in some of the schools in the CHEF, they call it the CHEF system, I cringe, but you'll see that children in those schools are doing even better than children who are in suburban schools. I wish to point out, though, that when we talk about isolation, people tend to think we're talking about children of color, but children who are white and isolated suffer the same disadvantage, because when they get out into the work world, the real world, where there's all different kinds of people, they will have difficulty functioning in that environment. But when you have diversity in the classroom, you have many different opinions, you foster critical thinking, you foster knowledge of other people, you foster ways to prepare yourself on how to react and how to get along with people other than those who look like yourself.
Like Elizabeth, Principal Karen Stedman believes the benefits of an integrated education go far beyond the academic.
You know, I mean, the focus has really been on high-quality schools, but segregated schools, and that's not going to solve the problems that we have in this country. We have to get together and know each other as communities. And one of the ways that we know each other as communities is by going to integrated schools. And that was really brought home to me when I start. I'm in touch with the first group of students who graduated from my previous magnet school in 2005. They were the first graduating class. And it was one of the early magnet schools in Hartford. And many of them are now getting married and having children. And as I look at their announcements, the number of interracial marriages is absolutely astounding in this particular class of students. It certainly is way above and beyond the national average. And that's what we need. We need students to understand one another as humans. And, you know, I'm delighted when I see the faces of my students and their spouses. And that's how we get to know one another. That's how we break down the racial problems in this country.
But most schools in America aren't like the IB Academy. Many students don't know each other as humans. And it strikes me that this goes to the heart of the country's problem with race. All too often, perceptions can be based on the abstract and on stereotypes. And so, in the final episode of America in Black and White on the BBC World Service, I'll be looking at how black lives and blackness are portrayed in the media, how issues around race are discussed, and at what it means to be black in America today. America in Black and White on the BBC World Service was presented by me, Rajini Vaidyanathan, and produced by Giles Edwards.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. The details of them all go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.